The United States Court of International Trade is now in session. The Honorable Gary S. Katzmann presiding before court number 19-00026, Liu Yang Bearing Corporation versus the United States et al. Will the attorneys please state their names for the record, starting with the plaintiff? Mr. Sim?
Oh, sorry. I was on mute. I'm Edmund Sim. I'm from the law firm of Appleton Luff, and we represent the plaintiff, Liu Yang. Apologies.
Good morning, Your Honor. This is Kelly Kristiniak on behalf of the United States, and also on the line is Nikki Kalbing with the Department of Commerce.
Good morning. This is Geert de Prest of Chagrin Associates, and we represent the Timken Company, which is a defendant intervener in this case.
Good morning, counsel. This is Judge Katzmann, and thank you very much for participating in our tele-argument in this time of the pandemic. These challenging times, we are all moving forward the best we can. As this is a case, of course, involving the United States Department of Commerce's anti-dumping duty rate determination regarding tapered roller bearings from China. The court is fully familiar with and has read your various filings, your briefs, the record. And as counsel know, on March 24th, the court sent each of you questions, detailed questions, to be answered in preparation for the argument this morning. And on Monday, the court received from counsel detailed answers. And the court is most appreciative of that. The session this morning, the argument this morning, is intended to be largely an opportunity for the you, counsel, to respond to the answers that were provided by opposing counsel on Monday. The questions that were submitted and that you answered reflect the concerns of the court, and it is hoped that because we've received your answers, that that will promote judicial and litigation efficiency this morning. The I understand it, and as you know, each side will be given allotted 30 minutes. So the plaintiff, Mr. Sim, will have 30 minutes, and the defendant and the defendant interveners will have 30 minutes. And my understanding is that the government will be using about 20 minutes of the 30 minutes, and that Mr. DePriest will, on behalf of the defendant intervener, will be arguing 10 minutes. Am I correct in those understandings, Mr. Sim? Did you?
Yes, that's correct.
And Ms. Christine Yak?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Mr. DePriest?
Yes, that is my understanding as well. Thank you, Your Honor.
So without any further delay, and I should also say, as you know, that these this oral argument is being recorded, and that upon completion of the argument, the recording will be posted on the court's website And when you go to the Court of International Trade website page, see the location of the posting of the recording, which will happen very soon after the completion of the argument. Mr. Sim, are you ready to begin your presentation?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much. And as a preliminary note, I just note for posterity that the last time I did a teleargument was 30 years ago with the late Judge Tsoukalos on a TRO, emergency TRO, and I thus will follow the one overriding instruction that the late judge gave a young counsel, which was keep it short, counsel. So with that regard, preliminary note, Your Honor, I'm Edmund Sim from the law firm of Appleton Luff. We represent the plaintiff, Lo Yang. On behalf of our client and our firm, I would like to express our appreciation for the court's ongoing considerations of the issues and arguments presented by the parties in this litigation during this difficult time. We appreciate the opportunity to present our arguments via teleconference. I would like to start by drawing the court's attention to the underlying purpose of the separate rates test in a non-market economy anti-dumping proceeding, and that is to determine the independence of the respondent company in its export activities. Can or do they act independently? What does the record show? The purpose of the test is not to determine whether the respondent company is independent of the non-market economy government in general. Instead, what does the record really show when it comes to respondents' actual business activities when it comes to exporting? All governments, whether in a market economy or a non-market economy, exercise some degree of compulsory power over their citizens and businesses. Hence, all companies are subject to some degree of government control on their activities. Indeed, companies are creations of the government by virtue of laws governing corporate entities. Thus, the question presented by the separate rate test is whether the government exercises sufficient compulsory control over a respondent company with regard to its export activities so as to render it part of the non-market economy entity as an exporter. The question in the separate rate test is whether the indicia of the separate rates test show that the respondent company is sufficiently independent in its export activities. In other words, if the separate rates test merely is whether the respondent company is completely separate from the state, then no company would ever satisfy the separate rates test. Again, I don't want to go too far on this point, but all companies are subject to the control of the government. The question is to what extent the control affects export activities. And it is the department's job to focus on this point in particular. This is why it's important to examine both the de jure and the de facto prongs of the separate rates test so that its purpose to examine its response export activities remains the primary focus of the test. Thus, Lo Yang notes that Commerce's current application of the separate rates test, both currently and in the proceeding under appeal, does seem to render that any presence of state ownership in the Chinese respondent's ownership structure will automatically result in the denial of a separate rate, despite the continuing applicability of the rest of the separate rate test under Commerce regulations. The citizens of any Chinese government entity in the response upward chain of corporate ownership invariably short-circuits any further comments or efforts on Commerce's part in its traditional regulatory de facto separate rates analysis, despite relevant record evidence presented with respect to other still relevant factors in Commerce's de facto analysis. The short-circuiting of the process means an appeal to this court represents the first meaningful opportunity for such respondents to present their evidence and arguments and have them considered in a full and impartial way. This is why, in our view, the futility exception to administrative exhaustion applies to this case. With regard to the actual application of separate rates test criteria, we believe that Lo Yang has explained why it qualifies for a separate rate in its briefs before this court and in the submissions made to the department. Defender intervener notes that Lo Yang had qualified for a separate rate in previous segments of this proceeding. This is correct. What has changed is how the department has applied the separate rates test, e.g. the short-circuiting of the separate rates test based on government ownership that we described in our briefs. These previous determinations thus evidence that Lo Yang would have otherwise been deemed independent in his export activities to qualify for a separate rate but for the short-circuiting of the test. Finally, should Commerce wish to modify the separate rate test, even including modifying its underlying purpose, then it has the legal authority and regulatory mechanisms for doing so. However, Loyan contends here that the separates test, as it pertains to this particular period of review, shouldn't involve the full consideration of both prongs of the separates test. This concludes our presentation. We'd be pleased to take questions from the court.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sim. Just want to follow up on the issue of exhaustion of administrative remedies. As you know, the defendant intervener argue that your client's claim, Lo Yang's claim, should be dismissed because it did not first exhaust its administrative remedies before Commerce. And you referenced in your presentation the your contention that doing so would have been futile. I want to focus you for a moment on the Federal Circuit case, and you've briefed that this case, and you're aware of the case as your answer to the submissions. Questions demonstrates, but the case is Corus Stahl BV versus United States, Federal Circuit case from 2007, where the Federal Circuit said that requiring Corus to set forth its factual and legal arguments in detail in a case brief would have had potential value, either by resulting in possible relief or at least providing the agency an opportunity to set forth its position in a manner that would facilitate judicial review. So the question for you is, what are the circumstances here that justify Lo Yang's not filing a case brief as other parties have done in these proceedings?
Well, Your Honor, we take the position that the current, at least at the time of the decision, and in fact even going now, the current approach by the department in the separates test makes the effort futile. Basically, this is, you know, as I referred to in the statement, there is no more analysis of the corporate of the company if and when you find any element of state ownership in the corporate structure of the company. And so based on that, it frankly, you know, what we argued in the briefs was that whatever it is that the department could have looked at in a final determination based on arguments presented by that would have hypothetically been put forward by Lo Yang, the value is relatively low because, or in fact non-existent, because to the court appeal or to the department, because the department already had decided and has decided repeatedly in these cases that the element of the state ownership in the company renders the rest of the decision, a separates test, to be an academic exercise and therefore moot. So I understand the point in the Stahl case. However, our view is that the value that the court is talking about is not material either to this appeal or to the department's analysis.
Thank you, counsel. Is there anything else that you wish to say at this point?
No, Your Honor. I don't have anything to add.
Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We will now move to the defendant with the Department of Justice and also Department of Commerce. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. This is Kelly Kristiniak on behalf of the United States. And I will similarly try to keep my presentation relatively brief, but there are just a few points I wanted to highlight, several of which are already indicated in the questions that the court sent to the parties. The court was just referring to the Corus Stahl decision out of the Federal Circuit, and we do feel that this is a binding decision on this case. The factual circumstances of Corus Stahl are very similar in that case, the issue was whether or not an importer had absorbed duties rather than passed them on to their customers. And it was a fact-intensive issue, not unlike the analysis of de facto versus de jure government control. And as the court, I believe, referred to some of this language just a bit earlier, but I would like to read it for the record. I'm on page 1380 of the decision, Your Honor. And there the court said that even if it was unlikely that Commerce would adopt Corus's legal arguments as to the standards that should govern a duty absorption inquiry, it was still possible that upon a full airing, Commerce might have accepted Corus's factual showing that it had not absorbed anti-dumping duties, thereby obviating the need for judicial review. And just a bit later, the court says, requiring Corus to set forth its factual and legal arguments in detail in its case brief would have had the potential value either by resulting in possible relief for Corus or at least providing the agency an opportunity to set forth its position in a manner that would facilitate judicial review. And it's our position that that is exactly on point for the situation that the court is presented with. It's not contested that though Liu Yang did submit responses to the questionnaires issued by Commerce as a mandatory respondent, it did not file a case brief and it did not file a rebuttal brief. And therefore, all of these factual assertions that Liu Yang points to in both its opening brief and its reply brief, all these factual assertions that it say would have established that the government did not have de facto or de jure control over the company were not actually ever raised to Commerce. And Commerce was therefore not allowed to, as the Corus court said, provided an opportunity to set forth its position in a manner that would facilitate judicial review. And so what we have here is essentially, Your Honor, the plaintiff asking the court to become the finder of fact. And I believe Mr. Sim just referred to, in their answers, they refer multiple times to this being the first meaningful review or the first objective review that this information could possibly receive. And so what they are asking the court to do is essentially step into the shoes of Commerce as the administering agency and take a look at those facts for what they say will be the actual first time and make a determination as to whether or not they have rebutted the presumption of government control. As the court is well aware, that is not the role that this court is meant to play. This court's role is to determine whether or not Commerce's determination is in accordance with substantial evidence. It's not contested that these are fact-based inquiries. I believe the answers submitted by plaintiffs on Monday refer to this particular issue as, quote, fact-intensive on several occasions. And so it is our position that we are firmly within the Corus stall holding out of the Federal Circuit and that thus this court must dismiss this case for failure to exhaust administrative remedies. And there's just one slight point I would like to make, and we did not get into this in our briefing, but the implication of plaintiff's position is that it did not matter what facts they presented to Commerce in their case brief. Commerce had already decided and would have not considered those facts in making their determination. I'm sure this is not the implication they are getting at, Your Honor, but it does get a little bit close to asserting bad faith. There is, of course, a presumption of regularity in the actions of an agency official, and that presumption extends to Commerce, and this idea that when presented with a factual argument, they would take it seriously, consider it, and respond to it. I'm sure the court is aware, there's a presumption of regularity, and there's also the standard to establish bad faith on behalf of a government employee is the very famous phrase, well-nigh irrefragable proof, which, of course, comes from the AmPro decision out of the Federal Circuit in 2002. There's been no assertions that there is anything remotely close to that in the record. So, once again, to the extent there's an assertion that that Commerce would not have taken seriously the case briefs and responded to them fully, we would disagree with that.
Were there other parties involved in this proceeding, which at the administrative level, who submitted case briefs?
Yes, Your Honor. There were multiple respondents who submitted case briefs. And I believe actually relevant here, there was one respondent who was initially denied separate rate status. And during the course of the proceedings, Commerce actually reversed course and granted them separate rate by the time the final determination was issued. I do want to note it's a factually different circumstance there. It wasn't a question of government control. In that case, it was a respondent who had been denied separate rate status due to some adverse facts available issues in the prior period of review. So I don't want to draw too close an analogy there. However, it is relevant to the court's review that there was, in fact, one respondent for whom the separate rates analysis actually did change during the course of proceedings.
Thank you.
Apologies, Your Honor.
No, I said thank you for your response.
And if I just may very also briefly, Your Honor, I did want to just talk a little bit about the repeated references to, quote, attenuated ownership. I believe in his presentation just now, Mr. Sim referred to, quote, any element of state ownership being some sort of automatic litmus test, and you have automatically failed the test. As the court indicated in one of its questions to plaintiffs, the finding that was actually made by Commerce here was not some attenuated 4 or 5 levels up, lower level of government control. This is set forth in the PDM, the Preliminary Determination Memoranda at page 10, but based on the information that was placed on the record, Liu Yang is majority owned by a company named Henan Machinery, which in turn is 100% owned by SASAC, which of course is the government-controlled entity, is a government entity. In addition to that ownership, Commerce determined that the Henan Machinery, by virtue of its majority ownership, has control over the composition of Liu Yang's board, and that in turn, that board selects the management. And that, in fact, there was overlap between the managers and the board of Liu Yang and Henan Machinery. So, A, this goes to the fact-intensive nature of these kinds of inquiries. It's not a simple question of law or policy. And B, we did just want to make sure the record was clear with regard to the actual determination that was made by Commerce. And I apologize, Your Honor, I'm just reviewing my notes very briefly. With regard to the plaintiff's response to question 8, which was about the Yontai brief or the Yontai case, their response was essentially that every case is reviewed on its own record and the facts stand different. Of course, Commerce agrees with that. That is something I think that we use in our briefs very frequently. But I did just want to point out that the opposite position appears to have been taken by plaintiffs in their reply at page 4, where they actually say that the fact that the government cited to the Yontai brief as a relatively similar factual pattern, and in that case, of course, the court found that they had failed to rebut the presumption, serves to prove that in this case it was futile for them to file a brief. So I did just want to point out that inconsistency among the record because I guess consistent with our brief on this matter, we would say that, you know, it establishes that they may not have rebutted the presumption, but it does not mean that it was futile for them to attempt. And then I believe just finally, Your Honor, and then, of course, I'll take any questions. To the extent there was an argument about being made by plaintiff about it being somehow improper for them to be assigned the countrywide rate when that countrywide rate was the result of adverse facts available on behalf of another party, it does appear that our argument has been waived based on their answer to questions 11 through 13. And I don't believe I have any other points I wanted to highlight, but of course I'd be happy to respond to any questions from the court.
Thank you, counsel. I don't have any further questions. Note for the record that the government submitted a 14-page filing of its response to the court's questions for oral argument. Those are very detailed. The defendant intervener submitted 19 pages of responses, and the plaintiff submitted 12 pages of answers. So we come to this argument with very detailed knowledge of the position of the parties to the issues that are central to the court's consideration of this case. So thank you, counsel. Does Mr. DePriest for the defendant intervener wish to speak?
Thank you, Your Honor. I thought maybe that in the time that we have remaining, I could, with your permission, quickly go through the various responses that were submitted by Lu Yang to the court's questions. First, I want to say I fully endorse the excellent points that were made by counsel for the government. I thought that if I went question by question, maybe that might shed an additional light on what our positions would be. On the first question, which was what record evidence supports Lo Yang's position that arguing its arguments before Commerce would have been futile. I note that Lu Yang basically refers to the evidence of it that it had reviewed in its 56-2 brief, and I do think that these are all that Lu Yang makes interesting arguments there, but those arguments really should have been presented to the agency first. I mean, those are all sort of economic and policy arguments that traditionally the agency has dealt with many times, not just in non-market economy cases, but it deals with economic questions all the time. And so these are questions that the agency is designed to handle and has handled in the past. And so, and if that evidence had been reviewed in the case brief, then we would have seen Commerce's discussion of these very interesting arguments in the final decision, and the court would have had a chance, you know, to make a judgment that is in conformance with the actual standard of review, and basically Lu Yang short-circuited that outcome by simply not filing a brief. I think by not filing a case brief, they essentially ended their issue. Then on the second question, which is how does the court distinguish between a likely a decision that is likely a particular outcome or virtually guaranteed a particular outcome, so that the futility exception should be applied because the decision is, you know, a done deal, it's guaranteed. Lu Yang doesn't really offer any criteria in response to what the question itself, but then it says that Commerce's negative decision was guaranteed because if there's any ownership by the government through SASAC, however attenuated, then the Commerce Department will decide that the presumption has not been rebutted. I think Government Council has touched on this too. What I wanted to add was that there's a discussion in Zhejiang Refrigerants where Judge Barnett reviews Commerce's decision making to some degree, and then so it's clear from that discussion that, you know, there's various levels of government ownership. And if the government ownership is minority ownership, then it would be effective for an applicant to bring in evidence that speaks to the legal separation between the government owners and the applicant, and that may rebut the presumption. And that, of course, is different if the evidence instead indicates that the government has a majority ownership in the applicant's company, which of course is the case here, and not only is it majority ownership, it's near complete ownership, as you know, as I think my brief and I think the government's brief too have made the comparisons with Yantai, and you know, the ownership here is more direct than it is in Yantai. Then the third question that the court had was why should the court use its discretion here to make an exception to the exhaustion requirement. How is your position different than that of other respondents and Commerce's in Commerce's investigations? And then, remarkably, Liu Yang admits that his position is no different. And then it says, well, we're doing this because we think the court offers the first opportunity for meaningful review of the record evidence. Well, you know, that that precisely points to the difficulty and the difficulty of Liu Yang's position, because they are quite literally, quite expressly, asking the government to take the first crack at the issues that they present. And this is exactly what the exhaustion doctrine is about trying to prevent. You know, the court, according to the statute, acts not as a finder of fact, but simply as a, I shouldn't say simply, because it can get very complicated, but acts as a, does a review based on the record. And admittedly, records can get complicated, but it is a review of the record. The court does not act as a finder of fact. It does not make de novo decisions. And that is what Liu Yang expressly says. That's why it is here, because it wants the government, wants the court to have first crack on this. That is just a no-go. So, and then the fourth question, how does your inaction, i.e., you know, not filing a case brief, reconcile with the Federal Circuit's mandate that the agency's regulations require parties to raise the issues before Commerce? And I'm not really I guess I don't understand exactly what Liu Yang's response is to that. It seems to argue that the Federal Circuit Court's requirements or instruction doesn't apply because it filed no case brief at all. And I'm just flabbergasted. I don't know why that would make a difference other than make it worse for Liu Yang, but I do on that issue, I'd refer to my answer to the my submission on the court's answers, which is to the first court's first question, Roman 2, Arabic 1, where we discuss the importance of the case brief and the agency's process. And I start with the same things that the government has pointed out about how important it is for the government, for the agency to have the first opportunity to resolve these difficult factual and economic issues. But what I also discussed there, and the government may interrupt me if they think this is not correct, but I think it's also important for the agency's decision making because. Just from a very practical viewpoint, because an agency proceeding will have different respondents, and respondents' positions, change as the process goes on, and something that is very important at one point in the process may lose importance later in the process, or people's budgets may change, or who knows what will happen, but. There is a very good reason just practically to require that people submit their position after the preliminary determination, because otherwise basically you're asking Commerce to guess at what their positions are. The Commerce Department, for very practical reasons, needs to know and what the party's positions are regarding the preliminary determination. If they don't raise their voice... if they don't raise their voice, then I think the department is justified in concluding that the party, even if not perhaps not happy with the result, is at least not willing to contest it. And so, that should be the end of the matter. And I will just do one more question on the practical effect. Should the court allow Liu Yang here to bypass the agency requirement, I think the effects would be profound. I think the practical effects would be that commerce would have a hard time. One would essentially be condemning commerce to make guesses at what people's positions are. Because where there's no case to be filed, commerce would still have to figure out what it is that they would need to respond to. And, that can't be good for commerce's abilities to, complete its process within the limits that are imposed by the statute. And I think it's also perhaps less so, but I don't know. It also will have an effect on the process with the court, because the courts, if they for some reason would be willing to take this on in spite of the strong mandate to apply exhaustion, and you'd be working with incomplete records, and you would need additional remands, and it doesn't seem practical in any means that I can imagine. Since my time is running out, I will stop here. And again, I thank the court for organizing this and letting us do the teleconference and letting us avoid the trip to New York. Yes.
Thank you very much, Mr. DePriest. I want to thank all of you counsel for your participation throughout this litigation. I assure you the court approaches this case with an open mind, and I'm grateful to you for your help in facilitating the consideration of the issues in this case. I will give counsel until close of business on Monday, that is by 5 p.m. Monday, April 13th, the opportunity, if you wish, you're not required to, but if you wish, to file a supplemental submission of not more than 3 single-spaced pages in response to the oral argument this morning. But that is your option. I will wish you well. Please, all of you, keep safe, be well, and I look forward to the time when we can all convene at the courthouse in New York. The proceeding is adjourned.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hi, Kelly. Kelly, are you still there?
We're sorry. Your conference is ending now. Please hang up.